The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on when whale watching turns deadly. Now, we're talking about deadly for the whales, right? Not the watchers?
That's right. Deadly for the whales. But the watchers are the problem. It turns out, and this study was done in Hawaii, and it's a survey that spans a 36-year period from 1975 to 2011. And researchers have been noticing that the humpback whales in the area around the Hawaiian Islands, they seem to be getting hit a lot with commercial boats. But they weren't sure if there was actually an increase in these collisions and just exactly sort of what impact it was having on the whales. So that's what this new study was all about.
So is this happening because watchers are getting too close? Are they like getting right up above where the breeding and calving is going on?
Well, that was one thing that the researchers suspected, although the laws say that these whale watching boats have to maintain 100-yard distance. So you wouldn't think that they're actually hitting these whales while they're actually watching them. And what the researchers discovered was actually two things. First of all, there has been an increase in the number of strikes, a number of ships hitting whales over this 36-year period. And what the researchers found was that the majority of the vessels that collided with the whales were these small to medium-sized boats, which are pretty much the size of whale-watching vessels. And actually, what the researchers found was that these whales were not being hit while the whale-watching was taking place. So it seems like the commercial vessels are maintaining this 100-yard legal distance. The problem is that when they motor out to these areas where they want to observe the whales, they're traveling at very high speeds, and they seem to be hitting the whales in transit. So it's not like they're looking for whales, they get close to the whale, and then they hit the whale. It's when they are actually looking for whales in the first place, when they're getting out to their spot to look for whales, that's when they seem to be hitting the whales.
So I noticed there's a picture on the site of what this kind of damage looks like. What are we talking about here?
The one thing the researchers weren't able to quantify was the number of whales that are lethally wounded or killed by these strikes. And part of that is because it's hard to track sort of what the impact of these injuries are. Are these whales just sort of continuing on with life and just sort of suffering, or are the injuries so severe that it's either killing them slowly or preventing them maybe from feeding or mating and things like that? So the real impacts of these strikes are unclear. What all the researchers know at this point is that the strikes seem to be increasing.
Next up, we have a story on French fries made in outer space. So many questions immediately come to mind. Why is this something anyone wondered about? And more importantly, has anyone actually used a deep fryer in outer space?
Well, they actually didn't fry these potatoes in outer space. But what they wanted to do is see what would it be like to fry potatoes in outer space. And the reason they wanted to do this is because this is the European Space Agency, and they're looking for ways to improve the space food of the future. Everybody likes French fries, so it would be great to know how frying works in outer space. They actually didn't take a trip to outer space to fry these potatoes, but what they did was they stuck them in a spinning centrifuge that really increased the amount of gravity that these fries experience, up to 9 times Earth's gravity, and at the same time, we're deep frying them in extra virgin olive oil.
So in the future, when we're choosing which planet to vacation on, which one will have the best French fries?
Well, what the researchers found is, first of all, that this increased gravity is actually pretty good for fries. It made them thick and crispy. It also shortened the frying time. And the ideal conditions were at about 3 times Earth's gravity, which is about what you find on Jupiter. So if you really want to make some good fries, you should travel to Jupiter.
Okay. Is this going to translate to kitchens here on planet Earth? Should we simulate excess gravity to improve crispiness of our fried products?
Well, it would certainly be a good marketing slogan, these fries were made in outer space. But unfortunately, there is some problem with the method, and that is that when they spin these fries in the centrifuges, there's water vapor that rushes out of the potato's pores, and that coalesces on the bottom of the fry, and that makes for a soggy bottom fry. So even though the rest of the fry is crispy, the bottoms are a bit soggy. So the technique still needs a little bit of refining.
Finally, we have a story on the breath of life and death. Okay, this story has kind of a menagerie of animals. Let's start with the tobacco hornworm. From its name, we can tell what it eats. But isn't nicotine an insecticide?
Yes, it is. But these little caterpillars have evolved a way to deal with this toxic substance. And in fact, they actually seem to be using it as a pretty powerful defense.
The mystery comes in now when the researchers look at low nicotine plants. What happens to the hornworms in that situation?
Well, when the hornworms feed on low nicotine plants, they seem to disappear. And the researchers suspected they're disappearing because they're being eaten by one of their chief predators, which is the wolf spider. And this is a pretty scary spider. You can see a picture of it on the site. And so they suspected that somehow when the caterpillars eat these nicotine-laced tobacco leaves in the wild, they're somehow using this nicotine that they're ingesting to ward off this spider.
So what do they think the mechanism is for using this toxic chemical to fend off wolf spiders?
Well, when the researchers looked a little closer, they looked at a gene called CYP6B46, which is active in the hornworm's gut. And what they found was that when they turned this gene off, there was higher nicotine levels in the hornworm's poop, which suggests that in the normal worms, this gene helps sequester this nicotine in the body. And then the researchers did one more thing. They basically administered a sort of insect version of a breathalyzer test with these caterpillars, and they found that they were exhaling nicotine breath every time they breathed out.
So they're not excreting it out of their skin or their feces, they're actually breathing it out. And how does the wolf spider react to that?
Well, this is what the researchers call toxic halitosis. And the wolf spiders did not like it. In fact, they ran away. You can actually see a video of this as well on the site. But even though it's a powerful defense, it only seems to work against the wolf spider. The researchers found that the hornworm's other predators, including big-eyed bugs, that's actually the name of the bug, and antlion larvae were not deterred by this toxic halitosis. So it's a good defense mechanism, but you can't scare everyone away with your bad breath.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how jumping DNA in the brain may cause schizophrenia. Also a story about how global temperatures may rise by at least 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. For Science Insider, we've got a wrap-up of some of our favorite stories of the year. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, we're returning on January 9th with a live chat about how preserving carnivores can save ecosystems. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.